Surprise, let's talk and let's laugh, cause I got so much to tell you, so let's go kick some art, art, art. Go kick some art, art, art. Go kick
some art. And welcome to Kick Arts with Emma and Stephen, proudly brought to you by Auckland Shakespeare in the Park. Kick Arts is Aotearoa's comprehensive art show, brought to you on Planet FM 104.6 and streaming live around the globe thanks to our podcast, which you can download from planetaudio.org.nz, and check us out on Spotify. Tonight we're focused on all things books with a fabulous lineup of authors and a chance to chat about some great reads for this summer. Speaking of summer, to kick off the show, here is 660 with We Made It.
I can tell by the look in your eyes that the storm's coming back again. I can hear in the sound of your voice that you're starting to crack. After all of this time, I'd be lying if I said that I knew how to do it just right. Cause the truth is, I lose it sometimes. And I need you standing there to remind me that I should say goodbye to all the clowns in my mind. Oh, I know it's been a bumpy road. Keep thinking there's so far to go. But take a look around, it's amazing. If we made it here, then we made it. No better place I'd rather be. All of my people here with me. Never took the time to celebrate it. But if we made it here, then we made it. Oh. Remember the days we were saying that we're gonna make it out. How crazy would it be if they could see us now? Cause we used to dream so damn big to be in a place that looks just like this. Open your eyes or you just might miss everything that we always wished for. I think it's time to look around and realize, yeah, I know it's been a bumpy road. Keep thinking there's so far to go. But take a look around, it's amazing. If we made it here, then we made it. No better place I'd rather be. All of my people here with me. Never took the time to celebrate it. As if we made it here, then we made it. Oh, take a look around, it's amazing. As if we made it here, then we made it. Oh, yeah. If you got a drink, better raise it. As if we made it here, then we made it.
Happy New Year.
Yeah, can you believe it's 2026?
I know, this is our sixth year we're going into on Kick Arts later this month.
That is quite scary, isn't it?
Last year just flew by.
Well, it probably flew by for you because you had so many months that you weren't here.
Now, we thought we'd do things a little different today.
Yeah, so this is a pre-record because Planet FM needed a break and so did we.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we're listening to a couple of interviews from authors. But then we're also talking to someone who's got some recommendations for maybe books that you might like to pick up and read over the next few weeks while hopefully you've got your feet up somewhere nice and cozy.
Yeah, and if you pick up any of these books we talk about tonight, let us know. We'd love your feedback.
Yeah.
So the first person is someone I met last month called Calvin Davis, a really interesting career in Army, then Navy, and then setting up a plastics company nationwide. It's a bit of a different story to kick us off. Shall we take a listen?
Yeah, let's go.
A big welcome to Calvin Davis. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Stephen.
It's great to have you here. I'll just get you nice and close to your mic there. Now, you're going to chat to us today about a very interesting story that sort of starts off in a Vietnam War that ends with running some incredible businesses. But before we do anything, let's just take us right back. Tell us a little bit about you. Who is Calvin?
Okay, I was born in Tauranga, a small farming community, Omakarara, in January 1946. Shifted to Hamilton, went to Hamilton Boys High School, and in the fifth form at Hamilton Boys High School, I realised that I wasn't a great scholar. In fact, I was a bad scholar, and lost interest in school and any emotional contact I had with the teaching staff. And I wanted to join the Navy, and I was accepted in the Navy and about May of the year, and once I knew I was in the Navy, then all further study ceased. So then I joined the Navy, and as you said, I had an interesting time in the Navy. It started my career. I learned so much from the Navy that set me up in my later business careers and things I'd learned from the military. But as a young medic in the Navy, as well as traveling around the world on New Zealand Navy ships, I got to serve in Vietnam, and that was quite an experience for a 22, 23-year-old.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So tell us about that. What was involved in being a Navy medic?
Well, okay, after our basic core training, we went into core training, which is learning all about the medical side of it, everything from first aid, anatomy and physiology, laboratory, x-ray, diagnostics, nursing, and we had the basics of that. But as we were promoted, we had to learn more, sit more examination. It was a bit like the old-fashioned apprenticeship. Rather than being all theory, a lot of it was practice, and you had to teach yourself. An opportunity came to serve with the New Zealand Services Medical Team in 1968 in Vietnam. And that was a collection of Navy, Army, Air Force medics, all senior medics, equivalent of a sergeant or above, and normally two or three doctors. And we operated in a small rural area where there's no other hospitals, and in a place called Bong Son, a population of about 1 million, and we treated civilians, casualties of war, and also diseases, tropical diseases.
Because when you hear sort of medics in the war, the TV show MASH instantly comes to you, to your forefront. Was it anything like that?
Not really. MASH would have been paradise for us.
Right, I can imagine.
As a good example, as I've written in my book, the first day I arrived, I walked into what was an operating theatre, and here was two Navy medics and one of the doctors doing surgery with their hands deep inside the abdominal cavity of a patient, a civilian, no gloves, no masks, no gowns, stripped to the waist, pistol hanging on the hip, and deep into it. And when I look back at some of those situations, there's many amputations we had to do from booby traps and mines and all the rest of it. But if we weren't there, then all of those patients would have died. There's no alternative for them.
So what was it like being so young in a conflict zone like that?
In my book, once again, I write about the emotions. It was quite emotional. I used to think about it at night. It certainly affected me and probably affected a lot of others. So a lot of the time I was working out in the boondocks, out in the rural areas, by myself, and was living and accommodated in an American army camp. And as the only New Zealander there, working the district and triaging patients, it was quite emotional and lonely at times. Mm. Lonely.
I can imagine. Mm. Can you share with us one of your sort of toughest or, I guess, most challenging moments from those days as a medic?
There's a lot of humour in the book about different situations where one old elderly patient, a Vietnamese guy who was very sick and nobody's looking after him, and I was looking after him. And then one day in the theatre, one of the Vietnamese nurses came in, and she said, they're all laughing, two or three of the girls came in, they're laughing. and they said Buxi Chalky. Well, Buxi was doctor in Vietnamese, and we were all called doctors even though we were medics, and Chalky was my nickname. They said that the patient had offered his daughter to me in his marriage. And from then on, the staff, the Kiwis and the nurses came through most days saying, well, there's a Buddhist monk out there who wants to talk to you. There's a couple of water buffaloes and white ribbons out there. And they gave me hell, you know. But unfortunately, a week later, he died, so the wedding was off.
Whoa.
But I never got to meet the so-called bride. But that was one. That was a funny situation, but perhaps my worst situation was I got caught in an ambush. And I was with three Americans returning home late at night on anniversary day, and we're all hit in the first 3 seconds. We saw these people emerge out of the shadows just on dusk when we were driving, and we should have been back in camp. And we're hit with a hail of gunfire, and we're all wounded. The Jeep took about 28 bullets. I got shot in the chest. And so we're only saved in those split seconds by two American tanks that saw my Jeep swerving. And I had difficulty trying to control it, having been shot and basically felt like being hit with a baseball bat. And it just laid me flat in the seat and my head hanging out the side because the Jeep had no doors. It was just sort of careering all across the road. So that was probably the worst situation. Wow. You know, your life flashed before your eyes when that happened.
What did your family say when you come back and tell stories like that?
Well, one of the reasons I wrote the book was because there's many things in the book. You know, it's called Nine Lives of a Soldier and Sailor. And if I was a cat, I would have used up four of those lives.
Okay.
And they're described in detail in the book, and my family didn't know.
Yeah.
They knew I'd been wounded because they got a telegram. But my girlfriend at the time, who was also ex-Navy, she was in England on an OE. And so I hadn't told her, but she found out through my parents. So there's a lot of life and death situations in the book that I experienced, not only in Vietnam but through my commercial diving career, where the family didn't know until I'd written the book.
And
there was a lot of questions.
I bet. And what a beautiful memoir for them to keep, and for grandchildren and great-grandchildren to keep.
Yeah.
When you look at modern medical practices today versus the tools and equipment you had to deal with, do you look back with pride on how much you managed to achieve and the lives that you saved, or does it kind of anger or annoy you how ill-equipped we were back then?
No, I think as a young person, I don't regret my time in Vietnam. There was a lot of anti-war protest at the time for what we were doing. But just to give the listeners an idea, the first day I walked into the so-called operating theatre, which is the size of a kitchen, and for the operating table we had a kitchen table, and we had a total of 28 instruments, which included a carpenter's saw for amputations. That's all we had. And most operations we ever did in one day while I was there, we did 22 operations.
Wow.
You know, that's from amputations, abdominal surgery, all sorts of injuries.
And what did anaesthetic look like back then?
Anaesthetic was very basic. We had the old-fashioned, what they called a Schimmelbusch mask, which went out of date in 1956, and we were using it in 1968, which is basically a metal frame that fitted over your mouth and nose with a gauze cloth, and you dripped chloroform or ether onto the mask, and that's what we use.
Wow.
And if anybody's got memories of having that type of anaesthetic in the early childhood, then you can remember the struggles as you gagged and choked. And so that's what we used, you know. Wow. That was our basic anaesthetic, you know.
So when it comes to writing these stories in your book, you know, what were kind of the rules, I guess, for yourself? What went in the book and what didn't? Because I imagine there's a lot of emotions tied up with that early time in your life.
Everything's in the book.
Nice.
I had a well-known author, Ruth Shaw. Many listeners will know her from her very popular books in the wee bookshops, and she's down in Manor Road. She's a friend of mine, and every question when she pushed me to finish the book was, is it in the book? And so everything's in there. There's no holds barred. All my emotions, what I felt at the different times. And my biggest emotional thing, which comes out in the book, was that when I was staying with the Americans, I was only with them for 6 months till I was wounded and pulled out. But in that time, out of 200 American soldiers, 40 were killed. Mm. And being the only Kiwi in the camp, they all knew me. I didn't know all of them, but those 40 people I knew. Mm. And so that was always sad, because we'd have a memorial service 2 or 3 days later where they put the rifle and bayonet in the sand and the helmet on top with their boots, and the padre or the commanding officer would read a few words, and that was it. But one of the biggest things, and I write about that in the book, is knowing that my friends had been killed, and I knew their parents hadn't been told.
Yeah.
And you look at the movies about Vietnam, and the military arriving at their door in some little rural town or a city, knocking in the door with a flag and a telegram. And I'd sit there at night by myself thinking that his poor parents, you know, tomorrow or the next day, they're going to know something that I know. And I felt a lot of guilt about that.
Mm.
As a 22-year-old, it probably caused post-traumatic stress in later life. You know, so those are some of the things, you know.
Yeah, thank you for your honesty. Are there people from that time that you still stay in touch with today?
Yes, there's not many of us left now.
No.
Because we're all... most of the team members that were there have died.
Right.
You know, but the ones that are left are probably all 77, 80 years plus, you know. Yeah. So yeah, there's more than probably three quarters that have passed on.
So when you left the battlefield, your attention turned more into being a diver. Was this all through the Navy, or did it carry on beyond the Navy? Where did this sort of spark of wanting to be a diver come from?
I was always interested in scuba diving, and in my early days in the Navy, I'd been taught by a Navy diver, just, you know, for weekend diving. We'd go chasing crayfish or scallops or something like that, so I learned from him. Then the opportunity came, even though I was a medic, and I was a chief medic at that stage, at about 28 years of age, which is quite old to be doing diving training. So I went on the diver training, and I was by far the oldest. Most of them were at 20, 21. So I had a hell of a job keeping up with them physically. You know, I did a lot of training beforehand. At night, so I used to run for an hour or so to try and get fit. So I discussed the different types of Navy training, what we did for diving, and then I added a bit of adventure to my life in the Navy, which I thoroughly enjoyed. But coming back from Vietnam, back to Devonport, and working in the Navy hospital, which was Band-Aids and Disprin, you know, it was pretty dull.
Right.
And I pondered long and hard whether I was going to stay in the Navy, and it was a hard decision. And that was one of the emotional things in the book, is the risk of I was going to take to leave the Navy, you know.
Mm.
So then I went on to commercial diving, you know, and I discussed that in depth, different types of diving.
Is there a favourite story from when you were doing commercial diving?
The funny side of it, one was that I was off the Taranaki coast working on the Maui field, and I would start diving normally about midnight, and I would be in the water for 4 or 5 hours on the bottom, and then I'd come out, decompress, and the next person, diver that followed me, was a Malaysian guy. And the job we're doing down there was a pipeline that carried the gas from New Plymouth, from the beach, all the way out to Maui Tower, which is in 360 feet of water. So we walked the pipeline. We didn't swim it, we walked it, with a ship positioned above, pitch black at night, our shift was. Often, because we're doing underwater concreting to reinforce the pipe, there was no visibility. And so the diver would be walking on the bottom, and with that type of work, you'd have a big helmet on, which gave you radio communications, it gave you your air or gas, and it gave you hot water to keep you warm, and it went circulated through your suit, and a safety line. And so we could talk to the diver, or not us personally on the boat, but the controlling and the supervisor could talk to him. And on this particular occasion, at about 5 o'clock in the morning, it's still dark, the Malaysian guy said he wanted more umbilical, which is the line that secured you, had your radio. He wanted more. And we could see it was floating on the surface. So the supervisor said to him, go back and check. You must be snagged. And then he came back and said, I can't move. And then he let out a yell. And because he'd only been in the water a matter of minutes, we could get him back. And he came, we pulled him to the surface, he climbed right out, he ripped his mask off, and he was a babbling mess, speaking in Malaysian. He finally calmed down, and what had happened, when he couldn't move, he felt all around him, and it was a large octopus that had him pinned to the pipeline.
Oh, no.
It was living under the pipeline, and he was the second guy to be caught. Whether it was the same thing, but the interesting thing is the next day, he was on the plane, he was finished diving, he was gone.
Out of
return.
Done by an octopus.
Yeah. By an octopus.
Literally.
Yeah, so that's a funny, unusual one, but there's many, many incidents about diving and getting caught in pipelines and running out of air, buried alive underwater, and it was just my feet sticking out of the sand, and other instances of other divers. Another funny one was in Bass Strait, in a diving bell, middle of winter, very cold, about 250 feet, and in the diving bell, which the bottom of the bell is open, so it'd be one diver in the bottom working, and one inside for security and to assist him. And all of a sudden you hear a hiss, and you think there's a gas leak, and you can't find one. You look down, and here was a seal with his head right up inside with his whiskers twitching. Stayed here for about 30 seconds looking.
Brilliant.
And then disappeared. He did obviously light the gas,
yeah,
which was a mixture of helium and oxygen.
Yeah. Brilliant. Brilliant. When you look back at your time as a diver or in the Navy, you know, obviously there's a fondness. Is there anything that you took from that time that you then carried through into your entrepreneurial life later on when you sort of got into the business? You know, what did you draw from those Navy and diving challenges?
I think there's a lot. One of the things I took from going to high school, which I didn't enjoy, and I just wanted to play around and eat my lunch probably, was going into the Navy. The education was like the old apprentice. It was a lot easier,
right,
to learn.
Yeah, yeah.
There's an emotional connect. You could learn.
Mm.
And it created a challenge in me. Even though when I was in the Navy, I was at the top of my career, earning good money, but I needed a challenge. And to give away all that comradeship and the enjoyment of the Navy and the travel and the good money, I took the risk of going out in the business. And when I first went out, I was going to buy a business, and then the guy decided he didn't want to sell it. So I was out of the Navy. So that's when I went commercial diving.
Right.
And but a lot from the Navy I took, you know, just the curiosity was one thing.
What made you finish the diving?
I had an accident, a rig sunk, and I was trying to salvage the rig, and at 4 o'clock in the morning, cold morning, a wire from the towing tug on the barge came across the front of the barge and smashed me in my thighs, both thighs. So it was a quick trip to shore and up to the hospital.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Yeah.
So after the Navy and the diving, what adventures did you get into next? Was it straight down sort of the business entrepreneurial path, or did you experiment with other careers first?
No, I was straight into business. I always wanted to challenge your business.
Okay.
What I wanted was a more challenge in my life. I didn't want to go in wages and work for somebody else. In my diving industry, I'd done that, and one of the companies I worked for, a New Zealand company at that time, up at Whangarei, I witnessed some terrible things between the different foremen. You know, it was a construction company, and how they were picking on a lot of the staff, and vice versa,
right,
with union strikes. But the foremen weren't good.
Mm.
And I looked at those guys and what I'd learned in the Navy, because for the rank I was, I had to go through a lot of leadership training.
Right.
And I took that, I said, this is terrible. I want out of here. I don't want to work for and put up with that. I wasn't happy. So that's when I wanted to start creating business, which I did.
So tell us about that. Take your time. Talk us through. What business did you create?
Okay, the first one I created, and which grew into quite a large company with branches and South Auckland, basically on the North Shore in the Wairoa Valley, then to North Auckland, Otahu, and then down into Hamilton. It was doing plastic repairs. And at that time, there was nobody doing plastic repairs. Plastic grills on cars were the only plastics available. So I started making some investigation. I found out somebody that could teach me. It was a Hungarian guy who worked in the industry for 30 years in Germany, who was the leader. So I got the equipment in from Sweden. I started it under my house, and I said to my wife, and this was straight after diving, where the salary was pretty good. You know, if you're into saturation diving, at that time, you could earn $1,000 US a day, tax-free, overseas, international waters. So that was big money. That's like $5,000 a day now. So I said to my wife, we're going to budget $50 a week. And but what happened was I got a tiger by the tail. And the work I was doing, I started under my house in my basement. And sometimes I worked till 3 in the morning, went to bed, got up at 9 and started again. And that was 7 days a week for 1 year. The only day I had off in the first year was Christmas Day. And so that created, as I said, a tiger by the tail, created good income, and the business just grew from there. And then I took commercial premises. And one of the biggest things I learned from the Navy, and I write about it in the book, and I took in a business, the Navy always said, you're born with two ears. You should listen as twice as much as what you talk. And it's better to sit there and look dumb than open your mouth and prove it. And so I used to follow that, and just listening to other people, people I considered that might know a lot more than me, I lose a lot. And a lot of opportunities are developed by just listening.
Absolutely. And where did this go next?
Okay, well, we started off with the plastics, and then I needed to do spray painting for painting those. So that part of the business grew into spray painting of all plastics, and then into everything from boat bits and pieces, motorcycle bits and pieces. But then during the winter, we wanted a heating process to heat it, because we're into two-pack paint. So we wanted to paint. So with a paint company, we developed the paint, which then I took to companies in Australia and America, and I sold it there. And it was a specially formulated paint, which we private labelled. And from the paint, we needed something to dry it. So that's when we learned about infrared, which I knew nothing about. So I had to get my son's sixth form physics books out and find out about infrared. And so I went to America and to trade shows, and I came back with infrared and started that in New Zealand. So I was creating and designing infrared for all types of industries, not only paint, but automotive assembly plants like the Nissan factory, Air Force, all types of industries for heating and curing.
That's incredible. I'd love to do a survey of how many successful New Zealand businesses started in someone's basement.
Yeah.
And I bet you there's a lot. That is that Kiwi way, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. You also ended up, you know, being an investor, but into commercial property.
Yeah, one of the things I realised, and I had a very canny old lawyer, he's actually passed on, and he was into property, and he used to just come and talk to us, and after I never charge us, you know, and so he was like a mentor, and he was telling us about commercial property. And then I met two or three good guys. They were property real estate salespeople, one in Barford and Thompson. And so they used to find things, buildings that we were looking for. So we had a thing. There's four of us in the business, my wife and a Navy person, Ray's still my partner after nearly 50 years, and his wife. And so the four of us set about with our business. It had good cash flow. So we'd look at the buildings, we'd buy them, and we'd use the surplus income from our existing businesses, plus the rental from that new buildings, and often we would repay it within 2 to 3 years, and then we'd go about buying another block of factories, and we just created until we had 18 factories, and we're just paying them off. And one of the reasons for that was the same lawyer who had 42 factories he owned either in trust for his clients or himself. He always told me, he said, if there's a downturn in the commercial world and you have to give rent relief, you can. If you've got a mortgage of 15% or whatever it may be and you're in debt, you know, you'll win because you can get free rent if you have to, as long as they're paying the service fees, the insurance and everything else. So we always remember that. And so we were never too far in debt.
When you look back during that time, you know, you just mentioned the lawyer as one. Who were other people that kind of inspired you or helped sort of lead you through this journey?
I had an old panel beater that worked for me. During the Second World War, his father was a mayor in one of the local suburbs in Auckland, and he told him, he said, Owen, you know, how much money have you earned this month? He said, I've earned £100, Dad. He said, how much you got in the bank? He said, £50. He said, that's what you've earned. And he was teaching me in his own way about debtor control. That was one of the biggest things in all my different companies. I had four or five at one time, was debtor control. The other thing he told me was he talked about the local doctor who was criticised by his the local people in the area, because if a patient hadn't paid within 1 or 2 weeks, he'd go knocking on their door at night to get payment. And people criticised him for that, saying they can't afford it. He said, they can't afford to not pay me, because if they owe me money, they'll never come to see me. And if they're sick, that's what I found with debtors also. You know, that if they owed you money, then they started thinking about it and they'll go somewhere else. So I always made it so the debtors could pay.
Good advice. Love the doctor analogy.
It was a good one.
So let's turn now to your book, Nine Lives of a Soldier and Sailor. What inspired you to suddenly sit down and write this?
Well, reaching my twilight years, 78 at the time, I thought there's a lot of things that I've done in my life that people don't know about. Unusual things. In the Navy, Vietnam, and the title, Nine Lives, you know, as I said, you know, there's four occasions in there where I could have and probably should have died. And so I wanted to put that down for the family. And I'd been to a funeral, a veteran's funeral, and I realised then in the eulogies that his family didn't know anything about that veteran, and I knew what he'd done. And so I felt that, you know, and you can go to any funeral, and how many times afterwards, having a cup of tea, think, I didn't know that about Joe or Jill. You know, I wish I had have known. And it comes in the end, it's too late. You know, so I thought, I've got to put it down.
One of the nicest projects I ever worked on was going into a retirement village with a group of teenagers and asking every retiree to tell us the story that they've never told their family, and then we created a piece of theatre for their family around all the stories that no one knew, but then the actual family member was in the story with us, so the audience could work out whose it was. There wasn't a dry eye. And stories of mischief, you know, the amount of grandkids that didn't realise how naughty their grandparents had been behind the movies and things, but it's so important, because otherwise those stories are lost.
They are.
So, great supporter of you writing it. Talk about the process, though, because you self-published this, so you've taken a big risk, you had to do it all yourself. What was the journey like writing this, and would you write another?
it was interesting. It brought a lot of memories back at different times when I was writing about this. The reason it made it reasonably easy to do it, because while my girlfriend was in England on her OE, I used to write 3 or 4 times a week.
Right.
And so she'd kept all those letters, and she still got them after 55 years. So I had all her letters. I used to keep a diary because I was by myself a lot of the time. I just write things down in my diary and stuff. Still got the diaries, and with the diving, I've still got the logbooks. And so I had all of that to work from. So it's just a matter of process. You know, I'd be laying in bed at night, and I'd be what I called mind mapping, and then I'd get up and write a few things down, and then I'd create chapters, and it would go from there. But I did hit the wall once, and I had to have a break because I couldn't get my mind back in the right situation. But I realised that the easiest thing to do once I started was to stop and forget about it. So I said, the only way, the challenge was, I had to tell 2 or 3 people that I was writing it.
Okay.
And so they consistently, how's the book?
Right.
How are you going? I knew I had to do it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I would have walked away from it. So I put a trap. I set a trap for myself.
And were there things left sort of on the cutting room floor where, not that you didn't want to tell it, but physically a book can only be so big?
There's probably a few things.
Yeah.
But I'd say 95% of it's in there, you know, the raw bones, it's emotion and everything and what I felt at the time. And because the letters and my diaries were quite descriptive, you know, and when reading those, it brought it all back to me.
Why did you self-publish?
It's very difficult for a person on a memoir autobiography to get out in the marketplace unless you're an All Black or a well-known figure or somebody like that, you know. Being a no-name person, and it started off for my family and then friends, and then the editor said, you've got to put this out there, you know. They were reading the book and they said, it's got to go.
Yeah.
You've got to do it. So I just self-published it, you know.
Brilliant. What would be your top tip for someone thinking of doing this journey, having written it now? From a self-publishing point of view?
Do it. It's going to cost a bit of money.
Yeah.
But if you can afford to it, do it. And that was the advice I got from a surgeon friend who did it. And, you know, so I've got no regrets.
Yeah, and you've really got out there and publicised it. You've done a great job. Yeah. I think I'm coming at the end of your journey of speaking to media.
Yeah.
But congratulations on that. A lot of our listeners on this show are self-employed contractors, business leaders or managers. What advice would you give someone trying to survive in this fast-paced world that we're in today based on what you've experienced in your journey?
Well, there's probably two things that I learned when running the business. Was I learned about KPIs, and I really studied those, and then in my later years in the business, I used to teach it, you know, at night classes for, you know, community classes that were done by different groups. And the KPIs in the service industry are very valuable. You can record everything, and you can see what your earnings are per day, per hour, per worker, per vehicle, per anything you want, you know, just on an Excel sheet. So that was one thing. KPIs are very good. We also got an award in 1999, won the North Shore Westpac Trust Enterprise Award.
Yep.
And that was for staff, teaching staff. And contract. Often we had some island staff or Asian staff in our industry who were very quiet and shy. And you could ask them, well, what are you going to do? You know, can you do this? Can you do that? So we found a technique. We'd go up to them and just, you know, shoulder to shoulder, be talking to them, and you plant a seed in their mind. What do you think this would work? And then when we had a group meeting later on, we'd pull that person out and say, oh, this person said we should do this, we should do that. So created their idea, and they grew it.
Yeah.
You know, they wouldn't respond, otherwise they'd shy, and English was their second language. But it just involving them.
When you look back at sort of leadership, the leadership you've given, but also leadership you've witnessed in all your journey, is there sort of standout great leadership moments or great leadership tips that you've seen?
Not that I can think of, nothing that comes to mind, except, you know, look after your staff. You know, sometimes unfortunately we often became a banker for our staff, you know, but that was one of the things you did. Just work with your staff, you know.
And you see, the book was obviously a, you know, inspiration for your family to read the stories. Now that it's out in bookstores and libraries, who do you think it's aimed at, or who's going to pick this up and love it?
Well, it's quite
and you've had some feedback already.
Yeah, it's quite surprising. I've had feedback from surgeons that have looked at the medical side of it, diving people, but probably most of the feedback I get are from the ladies, and they comment about where I was away so often, you know, on the ships, their insight into what military life was like, and the wife left at home. Like, when I was my first trip away, my son was 3 weeks old, and I was gone for 6 months. Now, that really got to women.
Yeah.
And they wanted to know more about that, and more about my wife and her role in it all. So it's been all different types of feedback to, you know.
Before we went on air, you mentioned that, you know, people were buying multiple copies, coming back to you.
Yeah.
Later going, can I get another one or another couple or a Christmas present? I mean, that in itself has to be the best Google review you can get when someone reaches out to buy more.
Well, I've had one woman come back and read it, and over a period of 2 months she's bought 5 copies for her family, her friends for Christmas and birthdays. So they can get that on an email. If they Google the name of the book, there's about 4 pages of shops that are selling it. Not all shops will have it now. Some will have sold out, and I'm probably not doing a reprint. But if they can contact me on email, and perhaps they can be on the podcast, you know, I'm quite happy. I've got books at home I can pass on.
And we should tell our listeners, you know, you say I'm not doing a reprint. You've already done 3 reprints, and this only came out in September.
September, yeah.
Yeah, that's incredible. Someone might be listening that wants to fund the reprint number 4.
maybe. Yeah.
We'll give the details at the end of where you can email us to get Calvin's information. You mentioned earlier, right at the start, something that sort of sat with me, and you mentioned some of the humour in the war. How important was that to survive?
I think it was very important, because the day-to-day work that we were doing, you know, it could take a real toll on you, you know. I can remember at different times we had some young kids, probably 2 or 3, and they were patients and they'd been burned. They were with us for many, many months getting treatment. And when we were going around the hospital ward, as it was, they'd often ride on our shoulders, you know, things like that. And so it made it an enjoyable, you know.
And more human, perhaps.
And more, more human, you know. Yeah. But a lot of the fun you had to create yourself, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there a favourite chapter in the book, or is there a favourite, a family member's favourite in the book that they've gone, I really love when you tell this story?
I think most of my family is probably my son. When he read the original PDF copy, he came back to me and he said, I didn't know about this, you know. I want to take you out to dinner. We're going to Plumsby. So he took me to the steakhouse, and he was asking me all sorts of questions over a wine and a nice steak. And he said, do you want to go back to Vietnam? I said, yeah. He said, good, we're booked. We're going in 3 weeks.
Oh, really?
And so he wanted to go back and see the areas where I'd been. Mind you, it all changed. But it was good. It was a good bond.
Yeah.
He thoroughly enjoyed it, you know, just sensing and walking the same steps and things like that. So
that would have been an emotional journey for you too.
It was so lovely to tell those stories
with someone.
It was, yeah. No, yeah. It was good, yeah.
Oh, what an awesome end to the tale.
Yeah, yeah.
So the book's available now. It is out in some bookstores, as we said, as some are already selling out. It's available in libraries, and you mentioned to me earlier it's also available through Amazon.
Yeah, on Amazon as well, yeah.
Brilliant. What a beautiful, beautiful story. I hope other people are listening and inspired, whether it's a war story or their own journey, to actually tell their story through a book.
Yeah, there's a few people contact me that said I've been doing, you know, group talks, people from Rotary to yachting clubs and church groups. So, you know, if anybody wants it, I'm quite happy to go and have a chat to them.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Oh, Calvin, thank you so much for this tonight. I think we could have talked for hours. I feel like we've just warmed up.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate it.
Well, now we are joined by an avid reader. This person reads, how many books have you read this year, Annalie?
I'm actually behind schedule, so I only read about 26. I'm normally up about 40 this time of year, but I've still got some time to reach my goal of 52 this year.
Summer holiday catch up, maybe.
Yes, yeah, I usually do a book a day during the holiday, so yeah.
Wow, that's crazy. So anyway, I didn't even introduce you because I jumped into the question. So joining us is Annalie Maddock. So tell us, where did your passion for reading come from?
Started at a very young age. I actually started learning how to read music and how to read at the same time when I was 4, because my parents threw me into playing the electric organ and how to read at the same time. And I lived out in the countryside in Sweden, and every week to school came the little book bus.
Ah.
And so there was no library around, so you had to go in and you had to choose your books for the week, and I just chose as many I could. And that's how it all started.
And in the last couple of years, like you said, you've kind of read, aimed to read a book a week, right?
Around 50, and it's just sometimes it's the best way just to escape for a little while, and I guess sometimes life gets too busy, and this year I kind of hit Netflix a little bit too much, but yeah, a book is definitely my go-to when I just need a bit of peace and quiet, and yeah.
When you look back at all the books you've read, do you have a favourite author of all time, the one that no matter what they're releasing, you're going to grab their book off the shelf?
Like My Roman Empire.
Oh.
Yeah, I have a book that I can't stop thinking about, and if there's a book coming out from that author, I always grab it, but that first book is always going to be like the one I just can never stop thinking about.
And do you order books, pre-order books, or how do you source your books?
So I follow a few bloggers, people are still blogging or like TikToking now, but on Instagram from America. And sometimes that's great and sometimes it's not, because those books don't always come to us physically to New Zealand as fast as they're released in America. But nowadays you can also get just download them to your Kindle and away you go. And I have Kindle on my phone should I be desperate to read, you know, so it's always there.
Are you cool with Kindle, though? See, I find Kindle very weird. I much prefer holding a book.
I definitely prefer holding them, but also it's just sometimes you're sitting in your car and it's like, oh, I have 2 minutes. I'll just read a chapter, you know, in my Kindle book or whatever. So I definitely prefer paperback, though.
Now, if our listeners could see you, they would see that you have a bookshelf behind you that's very full. So how many books, because you've just moved, so how many boxes of books did you have to move?
Those are always the first I pack and the first I unpack. And I think I gave away about 40 books to like a woman's refuge this time, because I just don't have anywhere apart from this big shelf behind me. But I don't know, thousands.
Do you go back and read books again, or are you very much once and it's on the shelf?
No, I do read again.
Really?
And I have some books from my youth in Swedish sitting behind me that I'm like, maybe I'll just read those again, even though I read them like 4 times. For Harry Potter, I've read about 8 times, so yeah.
Brilliant.
Is it different reading it in Swedish to English?
Not anymore. But for some reason, like Harry Potter, I started reading in English even though I lived in Sweden and I had no plans to move. So it's just for those books, the magic words and all those just pronounces differently in my head, obviously. But no, not really.
So let's look back at this year. What have been some of the highlight books, the standout ones that you think people should pick up this summer when they're at the beach and having their vacation time?
Okay, so all depends on what you're into, but I have a few 4 or 5-star books that I've written down that have really grabbed me this year and probably going into last year as well. And I also try and find female authors when I can, because it's so male-dominated like anywhere else. But, yeah, I've got a bit of both. So there's a book called The Wedding People by Alison Esbridge, if I say that name right. Most of these books you can find on Mighty Ape or Whitcalls as well, if people want to find them. And it's just, she's wanting, I don't know how much spoiler I'm going to get. How much spoilers am I giving?
Just enough to entice someone to go and pay the money and buy a book.
Okay.
What gripped
she
you the most?
She is going somewhere to end her life. She's decided that's what she's going to do. And it just happens that she's booked somewhere where they thought they had booked out the whole venue for a wedding, but she just happens to get a room anyway. And then she meets the wedding people, hence the title, and that just changes the whole course of her life throughout the book. So that was, it just shows you how you meet one person at a specific time and it can just change the whole course of your life. That was very good.
And was that something that you picked up and straight away were in, or did it take a bit to get into?
That one was straight in and I couldn't put it down.
Great.
Yeah. The Lost Bookshop by Evie Woods. It is old times and new times that goes together, clashes together. So you read about the old times in the same area and then hear about the new times, and then somehow it all gels together about this old bookshop, and it's very, very cleverly written. One of my 5 stars this year. I couldn't find a fault, and as well, I couldn't put it down.
Sounds a bit like Into the Woods.
could be. It's even trickier than that. Not so much fun, but just, yeah, it's mind-blowing. Then I don't mind reading a little bit of spice because, you know, I'm 50 plus. So, you know, that's what they say that we do. Abby Jimenez has written a whole lot of books, and the one that I fell for was, just for the summer. So, you know, okay, let's just have a fling this summer. And obviously things happen and yeah, and I'm not going to give too many things away. The House in the Cerulean Sea. Have you heard about this book?
No.
Perfect for theatre people, I feel, because it's a home where special kids with special, not needs, but special talents go, and they might not be accepted in society. So they just live in a little home together and they're hidden away, but then someone finds them and a lot of stuff happens. And it's just such a book full with such of love, such a loss of love. So every theatre person should read it. Mm-hmm. Definitely. My Roman Empire, The Midnight Library by Matt Haig. So you go to this library, and if you go to the right place and you talk to the right librarian, you get into this book and you end up with paths that you might have taken in your life. And then you come back to the library like, okay, what's happened next? Did I do the right thing choosing this path? What would have happened if I went with this guy to the pub instead of this guy to the pub? And it's so well written that it felt like it was possible to go back and go, should I choose this life instead?
Cool.
Very much recommend that one. How many more do you want?
That's perfect. For you... A book's like a television series. Like, if I start something on Netflix and I get 20 minutes into it and it hasn't hooked me, then that's it. I just, you know, delete, move to the next thing. Is it a bit the same with books? Do you, how far do you read before you make that call whether you're going to keep going?
First, I ask people who've read the book, should I keep going? Like, is it worth it? But then, like, if it's not worth it, then it's not worth your time because you want to be enjoying the time that you're reading. It's your free time, as you know, is just so scarce. At the moment, so we're so busy. So if we find something that we don't really enjoy, then move on. There's been 5-star books, so many recommended books that I just start and I'm like, nah, it's not grabbing me. So I move on to something else.
Do you have a favourite reading nook? Like, where do you go to read? Like, you've said you can read in your car, but do you have somewhere that you just know?
No, anywhere. Like, this year I had a bit of a, like I said, a bit of a slope in reading, and so that's when I picked up an ARC series. So I got advanced reading copies from authors. I got asked to read so that when it comes out, I have to give reviews and, you know, to help them sell. This is a new... New Zealand authors and American authors. And it was about Christmas. And I'm thinking, okay, it's October, but I haven't read for 2 months and I love Christmas and I love a bit of joy. So I picked it up and I got it all on Kindle so that I have 2 minutes of breakfast time or I have 3 minutes on the toilet. And I just pick it up whenever so that you just keep going and sort of get back into reading again.
Very cool. Very cool.
Very cool. Although now I've got visions of you on the toilet with your Kindle. It's probably not. Right. anyone listening for the summer holidays, is there, you know, a sort of, apart from your Roman Empire, is there that fail-safe author that you think suits sort of all demographics?
I think Sally Hepworth, an Australian author, is very good. It's sometimes a tiny bit spicy, but it's not really what she's about. It's about... it's more crime or suspense and relations between family members or neighbors. It's very psychological thrillers as well. Sometimes she's just very clever in how she writes. People love or hate Colleen Hoover. I love some books. I hate some books. So yeah, those are probably.
Awesome.
You've got a very talented family. You've had a really busy year. What are you looking forward to in 2026?
oh, I always love more shows. You know, that's what I love doing, but, and for my kids as well. But I'm excited for my oldest daughter to go overseas and shine in her university life in Brisbane. And my son has got his last year of school and he's doing a couple of shows, hopefully. So it's always show related and there'll be a book in there as well, or 5 or 25, but yeah.
Fantastic.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much. And maybe our listeners can let us know if they read any of those books, what they think. So they can let us know on Kick Arts or maybe comment on our Facebook page.
Sounds great.
Brilliant. Well, happy reading for 2026. We'll check in at the end of the year and see if you clocked over the 40 mark.
Please do. Now I've got a carrot.
Do you read many books over summer, Emma?
Well, honestly, I used to read a lot, but I was thinking the other day, I hardly read ever now because I don't like reading online.
Mm.
And, you know, I've kind of gone through phases, but I think a little bit like Annalise said in her interview, I'm a terror for getting stuck into Netflix watching TV, because then I can curl up in my chair and just watch something and zone out.
And I find if I'm reading, it's usually a script someone sent.
Yeah, that's
true. What do you think of this? And give some feedback and stuff. Yeah. And then you're kind of reading it a little critically as well, which is not always an enjoyable read.
No.
Because someone's wanting feedback.
Mm,
yeah.
Mm.
Well, we're going to really switch it now because our next guest, Deb Bailey, is a very different type of author. She's a leadership coach and she gives some great tips for all of you out there thinking about how you can grow yourself or your team as we head into this new busy year. Absolutely delighted to welcome a new guest to the show. It's the fabulous leadership coach, Deb Bailey. Welcome to the show, Deb.
Thank you. Nice to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you here. And look, when I looked at your CV list, you're a leadership coach, a facilitator, a speaker, and an author. Now, that's an impressive bio. Before we unpack all that, though, take us back. Tell us, you know, who is Deb? What's your career journey that led up to those credits? Because I bet that didn't happen overnight.
No, it did not happen overnight. So my career journey has been fabulous, I have to say. I've loved every minute of it. So I guess where I fell into the people and culture space when I was living in London, I lived there for about 5 years. And that, I just really started working in the people, the training space. And I loved seeing how people could move from where they were to where they wanted to be and that it wasn't so hard for them. And so from there, I came back to New Zealand and was very fortunate in working with Fisher & Paykel Healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is back in the days where they only had a couple of hundred people.
Mm.
And, you know, by the time I left, there was a lot of thousands of people working for that organisation. And I was there for 22 years.
Wow, that's a decent career stint.
Yeah, it was. And I think the thing was, you know, as a growing business, my role changed every 4 or 5 years as the business grew. So it was an amazing opportunity. Got to work with some incredible people all around the world. And then once I left there, you know, I sort of had one of those moments. Oh, what should I do when I grow up? I'd been there for so long. And I left there and I thought, actually, you know what? I might give my own thing a go. And so started my practice in 2018. And here we are.
That is so cool. That is so cool. So what does a typical week look like for you? If I'm thinking, you know, that mix between coaching, facilitating, speaking, writing books, is there a typical week?
Mm.
Or is that part of the fun, that it's never the same,
yeah,
perhaps?
It can be part of the fun. What I do try to do, though, is practice what I preach, which is getting that life by design thing happening, if you can. So I try to have particular delivery days during the week where I could be doing any of those things that you talk about, whether it's one-on-one coaching or training or speaking. And then I tend to sort of straddle the weekends with just in office time. So whether that's doing a bit more development work or writing perhaps. I mean, it doesn't always work out that way, but that's sort of the general idea. So, varied.
We'll talk a little bit later about your book, but I'm curious, do you have like a process for when you're writing? Like, is it lock yourself away? Or look, I had an author once that said they always got up at 5 a.m, had a hot spa, and then whatever came out after they'd had the spa, that was how they did it. Like, do you have your secret process that works for you?
Mine is, I've learned, because this is my second book, so I learned from my first one that For me, I need to also lock myself away. I need to have no other distractions. The place I write is really important. I can't write in my office. That's where I do work. So when I want to do creative stuff, I need to go to a different place. And, you know, I just hunker down. I just keep going until I go, okay, the brain is fried for today. I've got everything out of it. I'll come back tomorrow.
Yeah, that's cool. So what is it about the leadership journey and coaching that you love so much?
I think it comes back to that thing about seeing people move through and achieve things that maybe they didn't think were entirely possible. So I love seeing that in people. I think too, I've always held this belief that anything is possible. It's just about deciding, committing, hunkering down and doing the work. And so I apply that thought process, if you like, to everything that I do, whether it's actually in my practice or even just in my life in general. So I guess from that perspective, you know, because I am a possibilities thinker, I see that possibility in lots of people, and I'm happy to hold on to that belief for them until they're ready to kind of take it on for themselves. But yeah, people can do amazing things. They just have spent a lot of time sometimes telling themselves that they can't.
Yeah.
Mm.
Or someone else has, perhaps.
Or someone else has.
Yeah. Okay. So look, in today's high-pressure world, what are you seeing in our current leaders that are making them stand out from the rest, or perhaps fall down and not show good leadership, you know, due to the pressures on them? I mean, we only have to look at media. You know, we're constantly talking about economic pressures here in New Zealand. We see it. We see it out there. I mean, you only have to walk through our city to see it.
Mm.
How does that translate into leadership? Are you seeing good and bad stuff out there?
Yeah, I think, you know, where we see good leadership or great leadership, what we see is a leader who knows that often their success is going to be through the success of their team, which has a very different energy to it, right? Mm. As opposed to a leader who's kind of maybe just, you know, pulling or leading from the front. And so I think where a leader is able to understand and connect with their people more, I use this phrase with all of my clients, which is, you know, what I'd like you to think about is ask more, tell less. And I think if we can apply that principle in our leadership, and we're the leader of a team, ask our team members more about the project, the challenges, the whatever it is, before you jump in with what you think is the solution. I think that is a challenge that a lot of our current leaders have, particularly emerging or first-time leaders. I think because, you know, they found themselves in this leadership role, they feel they have to have the answer to everything. Mm. That's why they've been chosen. And it's not the case at all. So it's how they will actually get the solutions through the people around them.
I love what you just said, that their success is through the success of their team.
Mm.
Now, I lead a team. I've got 18 in my team, but I'm guilty of getting busy in my own world, my own projects. What advice do you give then to make sure that you are finding time to get back to your team, if that's such a key success point?
I think it's layered. I think the first thing for all leaders to realize is you're not going to do this on day one, right? You are not going to shift from perhaps being someone who delegates, for example, to team members by telling them what to do, by telling them how you would do it, and then sort of leaving it with them. And we see that's a pretty common approach to delegation, right?
Yeah.
How many times do we then, when the deadline is a couple of days out, do we see leaders swooping back in?
Yeah.
It's not done the way they want or anything, so they whip it back off their people. So I think it's about, as a leader, connecting and knowing your people. I remember doing a workshop with a group of leaders down in Christchurch, and they were all telling me how they knew all of their people. It was fabulous. And I gave them this little exercise to do where they basically just, they said, awesome, you know, go through and complete this little sort of template document about what you know about your people. And after them, I think all of them were in that position of going, oh, I thought I knew them, but actually maybe I don't know the things that would really make me leading this person a lot easier. You know, what motivates them? How do they like the expectations set? All
and,
those types.
And how different every member of the team is. Don't have one set of rules for your full team, because everyone is going to be so different on that journey.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love that. And leaders, you know, we're all humans. they've got their own lives going on before they even walk into work. What advice do you give to a leader on refocusing on their team no matter what's happening in their world? How do we leave our world at the door?
Yeah.
Can we truly do that?
I don't think we can. I'm not a proponent of that, I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my approach to leadership is a very holistic one. We are one person. So what's going on in our personal life, of course it's going to have an impact on what's going on in our professional world and vice versa. So I think one of the keys is to get really clear on what is in your current world. How much of your, what I call finite resources, time, energy, focus, money, how much of that do those things consume? And are they the things that are really important to you? So career is generally a key component of most people's, what I would call your life plan, right? You've got all this stuff going on. And so it's making sure that, again, you're not trying to be all things to all people. You're not trying to do it all yourself. You understand the key things for each of your people, like we just talked about, and that you focus on the things that matter most. Everyone would probably say they've got a to-do list with 20, probably more,
yeah,
things on it, right? But not all of those things are important and maybe don't even need to be done. I love that little exercise of instead of creating a to-do list, you create a to-don't list. What am I not going to do?
Yeah.
And just flip it on its head a little bit.
Okay. This is coming from the person who watched me go through my to-do list before we went on air today. Now I feel very conscious. What does leadership coaching look like? So describe a typical session or how you tailor it to suit a different leader's needs, because I imagine every leader's different.
Yes, absolutely. So, interestingly, my first book is called Inside Out, Why Leadership Starts With You. And I come from that place of the more we understand how we play out in a game of leadership, and you're right, that's going to be different for every single leader, but the more we understand how we do that ourselves, the better and the more impact we're going to have on our outer game results, because it's all about how we interact with those results, right? Whether it's building a team, creating a strategy, or delivering. So in terms of a typical process, that book was my COVID response. I had a lot of leaders at the time going, how do I do this leadership thing now that I'm not in the same building as my people? And so that book effectively would be my coaching process from woe to go, but it never works out that way. That's not how we do it in real life. When I'm working with someone, we always have a plan. We're always very clear on the outcome that we're trying to achieve. That's really important. But at the beginning of every session, I will ask the person I'm working with, you know, what's going on for you today? You know, what would be the best outcome for you today? Because if you've just had a team member have a major meltdown, or if all of a sudden this new project's come in, me talking to you about the thing we had scheduled is not really going to work.
No, it's perfect timing to deal with those issues at hand.
Yeah.
But that also would make your role quite exciting, because you don't know what you're coming to every day.
Yeah.
Do you have some success stories or those moments where you've walked out of a session going, that it really worked today, it really made a difference?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And
what triggers that for you? What's that moment versus a good session versus, that was brilliant?
Yeah. So at the end of every session, I'm going to ask someone, you know, what insights have you had today? What's stuck with you? What's in your mind right now from what we've talked about over the last hour, however long it is? You know, what have they found has been of most value? And then, of course, what are you going to do? Because it's great that we've had this time together, but what are you actually going to do? So for me, I can often see it. It's a physical thing when someone gets it or when they've had the light bulb moment. So I can often feel that in a session. And then it's following up afterwards, and you know, they might reach out to me or I'll be following up with them, and they've gone away and tried the experiment that we set or that they identified. Yeah. They've given it a go and they've had some wins, or they've even, you know, figured out what doesn't work for them. So it's those types of things, you know, and particularly where a leader thought that it was going to be really hard and that they couldn't do it. So
Do you balance, or how do you balance, I guess, driving a conversation when you're coaching versus perhaps just asking those key questions to let them drive it?
Yeah, yeah, that's a really good question. And I think sometimes we can get too attached to the labels. So the label of a coach or the label of a mentor or whatever it is. At the end of the day, I'm there to, which comes back to that list of things that you read off at the beginning,
yeah.
All the things that, you know, it looks like I do a lot of things. But what that means is when I'm working with someone, I could be in a coaching session, but we might need to have a training moment where I'm introducing them to a new framework or a tool or something like that. And so we flip around depending on what the person needs. At the end of the day, that's the most important thing, that they get what they need out of that session. And the next most important thing, equally important thing, is that it's something that they can go away and do something with. I don't really want to just sit there and talk for an hour, you know. I want there to be some really practical shifts that happen post-conversation.
If you were writing the infomercial for your coaching, you know, what would you say are the key benefits for a leader to be coached versus perhaps just talking to colleagues at work? And second part to that question, is it good for new leaders and experience? Like, it should be everybody in that mix.
Yeah, I'll answer the second bit first. Yes, it's useful for everybody. And yes, I'm completely biased. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, if we look at a lot of professional, whether it's sports people or, you know, largely sports people is a good field to look at. They all have coaches. And they don't just have one. They have coaches for everything, right? And we are seeing a subtle shift in business around that. But I believe that for most people, emerging leaders, yes, they need to build their toolkit. So doing training courses and gathering those tools can be really, really useful. The more senior you get, it's not so much what you do, it's the way you do it. And so, you know, I use a lot of diagnostics and things like that in my practice where we cut through it all and we get to really what could be contributing to what's going on. So, you know, we have emerging leaders that need kind of both, and with senior execs, it's a bit of understanding again how they're playing their inner game and how that's impacting on the results that they're getting.
That senior leadership too can sometimes be quite a lonely journey. So having a coach that's external, you're not, you know, giving away trade secrets or mentioning anybody you shouldn't mention, it gives you that neutral ground to actually have a conversation that perhaps at a senior level there isn't anyone high enough for you to go and have a conversation with. I imagine it fills that need as well.
Absolutely, it fills that need, and it also fills the need of, you know, unintentionally, I think we often set our leaders up to fail. And I do say we do that unintentionally, right? What often happens is, you know, someone will go into a leadership position, we'll go, here's your team, you're going to be amazing. We'll give them a pat on the back and off they go. And that often leads to this thought process in leaders that they have to have all the answers. And, you know, we keep saying how great they are and how they'll figure it out and all this kind of stuff. And so we're sort of taking them to that place where they feel they need to know the answers or they should know the answers, and maybe they're afraid to ask for help or to say, I don't know this. Now, it depends on the culture of the organization, right, as to how we define leadership and whether, you know, I don't believe in failure. It's all just a learning opportunity. If it didn't work this time, we're going to try something different next time. So it's sort of setting people up so that they can be successful. And everyone is going to be different. Everyone's needs are going to be different. There's a lot of statistics out there that tell us that, you know, classroom training on its own, which I don't do, by the way, very rarely transfers into the workplace.
Yeah.
People really struggle from going from that controlled environment now and back into the workplace with all the pressures that were there before they left, and now they've got to try and do this new stuff as well. It's often difficult for them to actually figure out how to fit that in, and the to-do list has just got longer.
Yeah, totally. Coaching's far more vibrant and responsive to the current need, where a lot of facilitated courses or online training, etc., it's very generic, because it has to be, because it doesn't know who's going to be hitting play on that button. Yeah, and I love that about coaching, that it can be so specific. Have you got sort of favourite coaching stories like that, that successful moment or favourite story or perhaps worst examples? What is it that always plays in your head?
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking of a particular leader at the moment who's sort of responsible for New Zealand and their organisation, and they stepped up into that role. It was a succession plan.
Right.
And, you know, I think what's happened over time is we overcomplicate things. We think because we're moving up in an organisation that the leadership has just got more difficult. And so I spend a lot of my time sort of bringing it back to the practical simplicities. Leaders already have enough going on in their world without me going and making it more complicated for them. That's not my job. Shouldn't be my job. So this particular leader, I remember in our very first session coming away, they had a specific thing that they wanted to be able to do differently. So I shared some tools and we had some conversation around that and how, you know, they could make this work. And at the end of it, when we were having those reflective questions, they said to me, "Oh my gosh, I didn't realise, man, I've been making this really complicated. That is so practical and I can see how that could work." So I think that's always one of the things for people to just be mindful of. Doesn't matter what you're looking at in the leadership space. If someone's trying to make it way more complicated than it needs to be, just be alert to that, because I don't think it has to be.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's turn now to your book, Navigate Your Impact, How to Achieve Goals That Really Matter. This is your second book. What made you decide that you needed to put pen to paper on this one?
Now, that's interesting because it wasn't the book that I was writing. I was actually writing another book, and then just with some life circumstances, I decided actually the passion book in me right now is this one, Navigate Your Impact.
Okay.
So the old one went to one side and I started working on this. And I guess one of the things that I've always, you know, again with my anything is possible kind of belief, that for us to be able to achieve the things that really matter to us in life, we need to be able to do a few things. First of all, we need to get clear on what those things are. And then we really need to have a process, a way of questioning ourselves. Are we really committed and are we really connected to this goal? Or do we just think it's a nice idea, right? And so the book effectively is a decision-making process. That's what it is. It's a way for you to go through, do some analysis around where you're currently at in terms of those finite resources, time, energy, money, focus, those things. Where are you spending those right now? And what is it that you really want in the future? And what does that require? And what's the gap? You know, and kind of going through this idea of sometimes we may have a worthy goal, a very worthy goal, but we're just not in the right life season for that goal to take place. A good example of that is that for me, back in 2010, I watched the movie The Way with Martin Sheen, a brilliant movie about the Camino in Spain. And I thought, man, that would be an amazing thing to do. But in 2010, I had two kids under the age of 10. I had the big corporate job, and it was like, where am I going to find time to go and wander around Spain for a couple of months, you know? So I just put it to the side. So knowing that maybe there might come a time where it's the right time, it's the right life season for that to happen. So I've only just been back.
Brilliant.
5 or 6 weeks, yeah. 2 months, my partner and I, we walked across all of Spain, nearly 1,100 kilometres in 48 days.
Wow.
So, you know, but it was just because I got to that place. And I think a lot of us.
But didn't mean you couldn't have the goal in the first place.
No.
It's just being realistic about when that goal might be fulfilled.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. Sometimes I'm working with leaders and they go, oh, you know, I want to do an ultra marathon or something like that. And we unpack and have a bit more of a conversation. And they've got 3 kids under 5 and they've already got the big job. And they're not even getting to the gym. So it's like, really? Let's have a chat about this.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, what's realistic for now? And let's not lose that goal. Because I think, you know, if that's something that motivates someone.
Could a goal now just be getting to the gym once or twice a week and looking at your life schedule to make that fit in?
So sometimes we just want to try and, you know, do too much.
Who do you think you've aimed this book at? Who should pick this up off the shelf?
I use the term leadership very holistically. So you don't have to lead a team to be a leader. We're all leaders of ourselves. So the book is aimed at anyone who is a little bit frustrated with not having been able to achieve those goals that are really important to them, or they just struggle to even identify what they might be. You know, I think in the busyness of life, we don't get the time to think and dream. We kind of maybe feel it's a little self-indulgent, or we're being a bit selfish if we do that. But actually, that's where our ideas come from.
How important is it to have goals and be able to articulate them?
Yes. Yes. And then to be able to go through that decision-making process around, is that a goal for now? Or is that something I will revisit in another life season? And feeling okay with that. I think sometimes what we find is people will identify a goal, unfortunately, often on New Year's. I'm not a fan of New Year's resolutions. And then within 2 weeks, they've already fallen off the wagon. But they identify goals then and don't really commit to following through in either the decision-making process, really unpacking what that will involve to achieve that. Am I really prepared to make this thing a priority? And if I am, what does that mean for the rest of my life? Because you can't focus more on career without it impacting another part of your life. So I talk in the book about, you know, I represent a life plan as a circle, because I call it a pizza, because imagine you're going to take a slice of your pizza, which is your career. Now, if I make that bigger, I still have the same amount of pizza. So I've got to make some decisions around how that priority is going to impact other things. And am I okay with that? You know, does that make sense for now or not? Instead of beating myself up because I haven't achieved the thing.
Yeah. And then remembering to celebrate. I don't think as Kiwis we're good at celebrating ourselves or celebrating that you've reached a goal that might have been just something that you'd set yourself.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely. There's a great book by Dr. Benjamin Hardy and Dan Sullivan, I think it is, called The Gap and the Gain. And this is the exact thing they talk about. You know, do we celebrate the gains? Do we stop and actually go, well, this is what I said I was going to do this week. What have we actually achieved, you know? And, hey, how amazing is that? And there's lots of ways to do that without it feeling icky, right? I think I'm a great journaler. There's so much value in journaling. And, you know, the second question I ask myself every day is, what were my wins from yesterday? What, when I look back on yesterday, am I pretty proud of, actually? I thought they went pretty well. Before I get on to what's my focus for today. And I think we're so tuned in to jumping to the what else can I add to this to-do list, that we kind of, we lose sight of what we've already done, where we've come from. And that's really important.
Can I talk a little bit personally now? You dedicate your book to your late dad, who I understand passed away as you were writing this. What inspiration did he bring into your world and book, and how has that kind of infiltrated its way into navigating your impact?
Yeah. So actually, that was one of the life events. It was my dad passing away that switched me from the book I was writing to this one. And my dad had a huge influence over, I guess, my professional career. He was the one that I looked at that he just always seemed to be able to achieve stuff. You know, and I didn't really understand how he did that, but I did try to sort of copy him and learned a lot along the way, because there were things that I thought he did that he absolutely didn't do. And so, you know, he was always there, I guess, as that role model for me, around someone who really did demonstrate that if you put your mind to it, get clear, decide, and then be prepared to do the work, you can achieve anything you want. And so I guess that's where that's come from for me.
Yeah, that's lovely.
You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
You've broken your book down into three parts. Can we just quickly overview each of the three? Firstly, the decision-making journey. What's your thoughts behind that?
Yeah, so I put that up front for all those people with the really long to-do list that don't have time to read the whole book. So, you know, the to-do list, it takes you through the steps. It's a recipe. It's a way of considering your goals to get clear on what they might be for the future. So that's what that process is, and it's laid out in that, you know, it's a stop-go sort of situation. So it helps you do that. The second bit that's around reviewing and taking action focuses on a couple of things that I am always somewhat staggered that people don't do, and that is people don't put time in their calendars to do their own goals.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're someone who's driven by your calendar, if it isn't in there, it's probably not going to get done, right? So that's simple things like even just getting the exercise in, whatever it might be, setting meetings with yourself to actually do the work. You know, I often work with leaders who complain about other people filling up their calendar. And I go, but have you blocked out the time?
Yeah.
Oh, no. So, well, you know, maybe do that.
And feel okay to do that.
And feel okay to do that. And feel okay to go back when someone tries to book over and say, I'm actually busy at that time. My calendar is up to date. Please feel free to go back and have another look and find a time slot that will work for both of us.
Part two looks at action and impact.
Mm-hmm.
Talk us through that.
Okay, so action, write it down. Mm-hmm. You got to write it down. You got to map it out. You got to schedule it. You got to get it in your calendar. The review piece for impact is around, celebrating the wins and then identifying what you're going to tackle next. And it sounds so basic, doesn't it, when I say this, but it's amazing how we don't always put it into action. Really, by the time you've gone through the decision-making process around, am I going to do this goal now or not, your action piece is a to-do list, pretty much. Just make it happen, get it into your calendar, schedule it, review it. Have meetings with yourself.
Yeah, I like that. Put your own meeting dates in. Take yourself out for coffee. Part three covers the overarching concepts and focus on our brain. Mm-hmm. And I love the head, the heart, or the gut brain discussion in there. Talk us through that.
Yeah, so we call this MBIT, which stands for, this is going to sound very fancy pants, but stands for Multiple Brain Integration Techniques. So there's a lot of scientific research out there that we have multiple brains. And the three most well-known and researched and documented now is the head, heart, and gut.
Ooh.
So head is the logical brain. Most of us are really familiar with our head brains. In fact, we spend maybe too much time in our head brains. But it's where we do our planning. It's where it's very quick moving. It's where our creativity will come from. The heart brain is to do with our values and our beliefs and also how we relate to others, the emotions that sits in our heart brain. And our gut brain is, it's where self-protection lies. It's where our identity resides. So I don't know if you've ever had the experience where maybe your head and your heart is saying, I really should do this thing, and your heart might be going, it feels right, you know, it lines up with my values, and I think that's okay, but you still haven't taken action. And often it's because there's either fear is residing down here, that's that self-protection thing, what are you fearful of, or often it can be we're not quite ready to step into that version of ourselves yet. We don't truly believe that we can be the person who either achieves that thing or does that thing. So as a coach, it's sort of one of the accreditations that I hold. So I'm constantly calibrating when I'm coaching someone, looking at them, because their language, their physiology, all of those types of things will give me clues as to, is this a head, a heart, or a gut brain, or is it, you know, multiple, and how do we move forward? So going back to your question about how do you ask the right questions? For me, a lot of that comes from that calibration with people. You know, what is it that's really preventing them from moving forward?
Brilliant. Nearly out of time. Couple of quick fires. Can leaders hit reset, like through coaching? Can they sit back and look at their own style of leadership and completely change?
I believe they can, absolutely. They may need some help.
Yeah, nice.
Mm.
And you self-published this book and presumably your previous one.
Yep.
What was your biggest learning from self-publishing?
Oh, the biggest learning is always that the writing is actually the easy part. It's everything that comes after that is more challenging. But I like self-publishing it. I like the freedom it gives me around content and distribution and those types of things. Yeah.
Is there book number 3 on the way? Because you mentioned the old book that you pushed to one side when your life events happened. Is that still in a drawer yelling, Deb, Deb, don't forget me?
Yeah, well, there is that. But there's also now, you know, lessons from the Camino going, Deb, Deb, over that side. So
we've run out of time. I want to ask about that trip. You'll have to come back and fill us in. How can people get in touch with you and get your books or grab you as a coach?
Yeah, best way to get hold of me is through my website, which is www.deb-bailey.com.
Brilliant. And we didn't touch base on the facilitation, but that you're available for sort of that corporate setting, not just an individual.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. As well as coming to speak at different events.
Yeah. Meet wonderful people like you.
Fantastic. Look, we ran out of time, which is always the best sign of an interview. Really enjoyed talking to you. Go and track the book down. Navigate Your Impact. We'll have all the details up on our social media throughout the week. Thank you so much for chatting tonight.
Thank you, Stephen. I appreciate it.
Well, two very different authors tonight, a bit of a different show for us.
Bye-bye, we'll see you in a week. Don't forget to brush your teeth and don't forget to go to sleep. We'll be going live, same time under the stars, saying blah, 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 blah. Let's go kick some art, art, art. Go kick some art.